In this episode of the 80s Rewind Show podcast 90s special, I speak to one of the most definitive voices of the 90s. And at the end of the show, I'm going to play you a track from their new album. Stay tuned.
I'm Jack Hughes from Wang Chung.
Hey everybody, this is Ivan from Men Without Hats.
Hello everybody, this is Francis Dunnery from It Bites.
Hi everyone, this is Andy from Modern Romance.
Hi everyone, this is Charlene.
Hi, this is Dennis Seaton from Music
Hi, I'm Nick Haywood.
Hi, this is Kevin from Fiction Factory.
And you're listening to the 80s Rewind Show podcast.
If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe so that you never miss an episode. And now, welcome your host.
Face for Radio Burgess.
Hello, hello, it's the 80s Rewind Show podcast, and this is the 90s special. I did my first 90s guest, and it could not have gone any better. But before we get on to that, a massive thank you to everybody that shared the show and spread the love about it, because it's been amazing. I've had some fantastic emails from people saying how much they're enjoying it, so thank you very much. And thank you for everybody that subscribed to the YouTube channel and has been watching it on YouTube. Links in the description if you've not done that yet, and you can actually watch the interviews. So get yourself on there, subscribe and give it a look. And you can see some of the fantastic guests we've got on there as well. And there's all sorts of stuff I'm going to be putting on there over the summer and over the next few years. I'm really enjoying the YouTube stuff. I didn't think I would, but I'm actually really enjoying it. I've always been a microphone person in a room, in the dark, that kind of thing. But I'm actually quite enjoying it. It is quite fun. Anyway, on to today's episode. On this episode of the 80s Rewind Show 90s special, we dive into the backstory of the iconic band Jesus Jones with an exclusive interview with the lead singer, Mike Edwards. We discover their struggle to get into the top 40, how they found inspiration from their experiences touring and playing music worldwide, and we get a behind-the-scenes look at their albums Liquidizer, Doubt, Perverse and Already, which took 3 years to complete. As well as that, we hear how they formed the band and also the inspiration behind such songs as Right Here, Right Now, and International Bright Young Thing, and Real, Real, Real. It was a great conversation. Mike's a lovely guy. We had a good old chat. And I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did making it with Mike. Once again, thank you for subscribing. I'm going to bring you some more 90s guests as they come along. And don't forget to stick around to the end of the show, because we've got a special treat for you. Mike and the guys have allowed us to play their last song, Wired and Wind Burned, on this episode. So check it out. It's fantastic. You're going to love it. Right, let's do it. So if we can just go back a bit, like growing up, was your house a musical house, or was your parents into music?
At a crucial point, yes. In the early years, no. Although my dad had been a choir boy and has kind of maintained a love of singing and opera and stuff like that, but it wasn't a major feature of the household. My mum was very into contemporary music. I mean, she bought all of the Beatles albums as they came out, Stones, Janis Joplin, Hendrix, all that kind of stuff. I got into music at the age of about nine, as kind of most kids do or did or whatever. But it was kind of around about that time that my dad got an acoustic guitar, a classical guitar, because he wanted to teach himself to play classical guitar. It kind of worked, and he kind of faded out over a couple of years. As he started fading out, I started picking up and messing around with it. And my parents got really irate with me doing this. You know, it's a very nice guitar that he had, and there's me just smashing away. And they said, listen, if you want a guitar, go and buy your own. Go and get a job, do some kind of work and buy your own. So I did, and it was really that kind of instigated me playing music. I mean, I often used to listen to my parents' record collection and think, oh, I'd like to do that bit, and I'd like to do that bit, and I'd like to do that bit. And it could be anything from the drums to the singing, the guitar, whichever was most prominent on the record. But it was, I suppose, really my dad getting that guitar and then insisting I got my own that really got the ball rolling. Because I'd say within a year or so of getting that guitar, I got together with Jen, the drummer in the band, and we decided we were going to form a band. And bear in mind, that was the summer of 1977.
Right.
No, 78, rather. And, so it all happened pretty early. And, you know, Jen is still with the band now.
Fantastic. And which album or song was it that really turned your head into wanting to play the guitar, write music, become a musician?
I don't know if there's any one particular one, but the first single I ever bought was Hellraiser by The Sweet. And I absolutely loved that. You know, I just loved it. It was fantastic. I was absolutely enthralled by it. And then after that, like I said, it was just more a case of kind of, I'd like to do that bit off paperback writer, or I'd like to do that bit off Paint It Black, or I'd like to sing like Jimi Hendrix does or Janis Joplin does here. It was that kind of thing more than any one particular foundational track, I'd say.
That's fantastic. I mean, The Sweet, what a great band they were.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, you don't need me to agree with you. You know I'm going to say that anyway.
I mean, Mick Tucker, the drummer, wow, what a powerhouse he was. Underrated drummer. Absolutely underrated.
I've never thought of that. I should go back and listen, because I still listen to Hellraiser and Baller and Blitz and stuff like that with my kind of pre-adolescent ears. I don't really pick much out of it in that kind of analytical way. But so that's interesting. I should go back and check it out.
Honestly, he's great. He's completely underrated for a 70s drummer.
Because really? You had John Bonham and such like that. I think he gets overlooked, but the man had such skills. Yeah. He was brilliant.
I think that was the thing with The Sweet. I think they were overlooked because they were kind of perceived at the time as very kind of bubblegum pop. Although it's fascinating when you listen to something like Hellraiser, they think, really? That was pop music in those days? Because it's a nasty piece of guitar playing going on there. And I think they were a band that were very capable and very good, had a strong style of their own, but just got overlooked because of their hit singles, really. In a similar way to Slade, I think, who were another band that were absolutely magnificent. I mean, Noddy Holder's voice, it's got to be probably the greatest voice in rock music. Astonishing. You know, there's a track off the first live album. They cover Darling Be Home Soon by John Sebastian. And it's one of many songs that's got a chord sequence in it that is exactly the same as Right Here, Right Now. So I don't know how influential that was. But at the end of that, and Noddy Holder just, he goes up an octave and he hits the chorus an octave higher than he has done before. And my God, it makes the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. So anyway, another underrated band. Sorry.
That's true, yeah. I mean, Noddy seems to have no end range. He seems to sing higher and higher and higher until he
Yeah, very true.
He's wonderful. So you got your first band together. Were you starting to songwrite at a really young age, or were you sort of just doing covers and finding your way through?
Covers initially, like everyone else, and then you start writing your own stuff, which of course was absolutely appalling. I know there are some people, and I think Jerry in the band has talked to Miles Hunt, because Jerry played in the Wonder Stuff for a short while to help them out. And I think there's one of the songs off the Wonder Stuff's first album that was, I think, maybe the first song Miles ever wrote. It was written when he was something like 16, you know. And it's obviously it's on their first album. It's a really good song. Yeah. And I'm just full of admiration, because, you know, I didn't write anything even halfway decent for the first 100 songs, I'd say. It was all absolutely dire before then. So that's impressive.
I said, yeah, and you get like George Michael wrote Careless Whisper at 16 or something. You're like,
yeah. I was anything but a prodigy. I think I was always one of those people that had to work very hard to be able to achieve the things I achieved. It didn't come easy.
Well, each road leads somewhere, doesn't it? Can we talk about just getting the Jesus Jones Band together, how it formed originally?
Yeah, well, it was a process of accumulation, really, rather than kind of one big moment. People came in, people came out. The constants really were Jen, the drummer, who, as I've said, you know, he and I decided we were going to be in our first band in 1978. About 5 years, 4 years after that, we'd already had a few permutations, and Alan, the bass player, joined. From that point, about 83, 84, something like that, that was the core of the band. And then people came in, people came out. Jerry joined the band when we moved up to London. This was 1986, 87, something like that. And then in 87, 88, I met up with this guy in a pub in North London who I could tell from his shoes he was a skateboarder. So we got talking about skateboarding, and then we decided to go out skating together. And then I said, oh, yeah, I'm in this band, and we've just got a bit of interest from a record company. Looks like we're going to get a record deal. We needed someone to play all the samples. And so I asked my skater friend Ian if he fancied just poking around on the keyboard and playing the samples. And that's really how it crystallized. It was not really, as I say, one big moment. It just kind of gradually came together, and ding, that was it.
Fantastic. Where did the idea for the samples come into the music for you? Did you write with samples in mind, or were you writing songs and added the samples after?
I think initially I'd, because I had a more of a traditional songwriting background, initially I'd put the samples in as kind of ear candy, but very soon into the process, you know, there are definitely songs on that first album on Liquidizer that are written that started with samples, so they were an integral part of the songs. I can remember clearly that the night that I'd bought this, my first sampler, which obviously, you know, very primitive by today's standards, but I was just amazed. It was absolutely fascinating, and it really opened the doors to me. I'd been listening to stuff at the time, I suppose, would be Age of Chance, really importantly, The Shaman. And this always baffles me, that but Pop Elite itself were never an influence on us, but they were certainly doing that kind of thing. I don't know why they weren't an influence on us. That's never really... don't know, it's a mystery to me. But so yeah, Beastie Boys, Run DMC, stuff like that, where some samples are an integral part of it. When I found that I could do that and I could do it really easy, it was one of those hyperspace moments, you know, when suddenly all the stars go like that. It was brilliant. Yeah, just an absolute eye and ear opener.
And was it easy to do samples live back in the day then? Was it easy to get that stuff to work?
Yes, yeah, it was, but in a primitive way. I mean, you had the Akai samplers, which were the kind of, they were the foundation stones, really. They're the ones that everybody used. They got the job done well for the time, but they were very, very primitive. I mean, the memory was absolutely tiny, and you had to have really hard drives to back that memory up, and the hard drives themselves were really small. And it's fascinating. I mean, now what we take around the world, you know, basically what you can do with an iPad, that was a 30 kilogram giant flight case that we had to fly around the world. I mean, now we're going to tour in America in the summer, and it's on a small, a 12 inch screen laptop, I think.
Fantastic. I didn't know if it was like the Who, where you had a big like tape to tape machine, a big.
Yeah, I mean, we did actually start with that. I had a 4-track Porter Studio, and I think we're very early on when we started down that route. We used that. Then we got our record deal and we got some money. That's when we bought the Akai samplers. But yeah, actually, so it was tape originally, cassettes, in fact.
I love cassettes.
I hate them. Absolutely detest them. What a dreadful medium. So many of the media were awful. I mean, I don't get the vinyl thing in the slightest. I know, you know, I'm aware that we sell them, and I understand all the other arguments. But as something to listen to, it's appalling. It was something that was just crying out for something like CD to come along. And now you don't even need that. I think it's brilliant, you know.
I'm a love vinyl me. So Liquidizer was the first album. Was it an easy album to make? Were the songs already there, or did you have to sort of write in the studio at the same time?
No, right in the studio. It was really hard to make, actually, because in the run up to Liquidizer, we'd been releasing singles fairly quickly, and in those days, to try and boost the sales of the singles, you would bring out multiple versions with multiple different mixes and other songs on there. So basically, in that period, as fast as I could write, the songs were released. I couldn't keep up with the demand for the record company for songs. I mean, they would, over the on three singles, you pretty much have to write an album's worth of songs, right, to keep up with that demand. So I then had the album to do as well. So yeah, a lot of it was get up early in the morning, write the song, go to the studio in the afternoon, record it, get home at midnight, get up early in the morning, write the next song. It was very much like that. It was really as they were needed. It was tough.
Yeah, it sounds like you were treadmilling as well. It was kind of just...
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't... The only time I really started getting ahead of myself is when we started touring, because you have so much time when you tour just to think about things, which is really important, I think, for creativity. But also then later on, when we got bits of technology, you could actually start creating stuff on the road. And it didn't matter if you weren't creating entire songs. As long as you had that initial point to start you from, then you knew when you had a clear week at home, you could really get stuck into 2, 3, 4 songs and get them well progressed. So it was kind of repeated touring that helped with the songwriting process, which is sounds ironic. I know so many people complain that they have no time to write songs because they're always touring, but it was completely the other way around for me.
Fantastic. Info Freako was the first single, is that right?
Yes, it was. Yeah, yeah. That was it was the first song on the demo that we recorded. We had a kind of make or break demo, really. There's Jen, the drummer, Jerry, the guitarist, and I went on this holiday in Spain in 1988. And it was pretty much, all right, we've been doing this for a while and it's not really going anywhere. What are we going to do? And I said, look, I've got an idea. This is how we're going to do it. I've got this sampler. We should present it with very much me at the forefront. And, you know, just leave it all to me. I'll take care of it. And that and we'll make a demo, and we got these three songs that I think should be on there. So we went ahead and we did that, and it wasn't quite finished when Jen took it into Food Records, who he knew as DBM Management. They were a management company. They managed people like Zodiac, Mind Warp, and Voice of the Beehive. We were looking for a manager, and it just turned out they happened to be a record company as well, and we signed a deal with them. But yeah, the first thing they heard was Info Freako, and that's the first thing that most people heard from us was Info Freako.
What surprised me was I was reading online that Bruno Brooks really championed that song, and he's the last person.
Yeah, absolutely. It surprised me at the time as well. And I was, you know, even then, everyone was going, what the hell is this about? Why is this guy doing Drive Time Radio 1? Why is he getting behind something that otherwise you'd expect to hear at kind of 9 or 10 at night, if you were lucky on Radio 1? I don't know. I didn't question it. But it struck me that maybe, I mean, he was, fair play to him. I suppose maybe he had his ear to the ground. We were starting to get some press. It did look like, you know, people were talking us up a lot. And maybe he just wanted to get ahead of things. And kind of thought, yeah, that's the kind of thing I want to ally myself to. You know, it could be that he just really liked the song and wanted it on his shows. But it was a surprise, yeah. That was one that we're very happy with.
It makes you wonder. I was thinking about it the other day that people in America won't know this, but Ken Bruce obviously has left BBC Radio 2 because he wanted to do his sort of own playlist, and the BBC insisted that he play certain records. I wonder if it was the same back then, and this was Bruno's sort of, you know, actually, I really like this song and I want to play it. If he sort of broke the format and got in trouble a little bit, I wonder.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, because it was very, even then, DJs didn't have a say. I think there was... It could be that we were right towards the end of his show and he's kind of played all the songs in his playlist, and maybe he's kind of talked for 2.5 minutes less than he normally did so he could squeeze our song in. I don't really know. Or it could be that, you know, whoever was in charge of the playlist, the program director or something, suggested he do it. I really don't know. But I don't think it was very different then. I do think that it was DJs played the playlist and without really any kind of deviation from it.
Yeah, it's true. I'll ask him one day. I'll interview him. And if I find it, I'll promise I'll come back to you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It'd be good to know.
So at this point, we're up to Day Out, the second album. Was that an easier album to write because you've been writing on the road and writing songs? Or did that take a long time again? Was there more pressure to write hits on this one? Did they sort of say, look, you've got to get a bit more commercial, you've got to get more radio friendly? Was it?
I mean, it's the confounding factor is that it's not like kind of we did one then stopped and did the other. It was just constantly going. I was constantly writing songs, and there were some things from the past that we'd bring back up and redo. Doubt came out at the start of 91, and quite a few of the songs for that were written at the end of, say, 1989. So some of them were already over a year old as far as we were concerned. But yeah, certainly something like International Bright Young Thing, its working title was Hit, because that's what I wanted it to be. You know, it was very important to us. At that point, we'd had three songs that were just outside the top 40, only just, and it was really frustrating, really irritating that we were almost there, almost had our foot in the door, but didn't quite have it. So the record company didn't need to put any pressure on me. It was me thinking, you know, I'm fed up with almost being there. I want to write something that does get there. Obviously, the record company were all in favor of that. but there was no kind of, you need to sit and write down a hit now. You know, it was entirely my initiative, is my impetus. So basically kind of the Doubt was being written as Liquidizer was being released and toured. I don't remember Doubt being anything like as difficult as Liquidizer. That did seem a lot easier to do. But I don't think it's as good an album as the ones either side of it. It doesn't, to me, it doesn't sound as good. The remix versions of the hits are what made them hits. And I think they are better versions than I would have been able to do myself. But at the time, I was going to think, it's not really the version that I wanted. So it's a funny album. And there's for me, at least, some of it, there's very little of it I really like, actually, I have to say. Right Here, Right Now, I've always loved. Always thought it was a great track. Some of it's good, but there are tracks like Blist, I think, is on there. Trust Me, We Often Have Fun Playing Live. But there are quite a few tracks I just... Oh, I know. Stripped. Yeah, Stripped was written as a result of going to Romania. And I listened back to it, 10 years ago, something like that, and thought, there's actually something worthwhile in there, but just not in the version that we released on Doubt. So we remade it in 2014, and we've been playing that version every so often, ever since.
I really like I'm Burning. I like they use the backward samples on it.
I think it's funny. That was one of the tracks. That track is, at that point, would have been about 6 years old. Maybe a little less, but not much. So I wasn't. We'd played it to the record company when we were they were desperate for songs, and I was thinking, well, yeah, maybe I have this one. And they said, yeah, great, let's put that on.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, owner and user of Mint Mobile with a special holiday message. If you sign up now for 3 months, you get 3 months free on every one of our plans, even unlimited. Now, I realize this is more of a holiday offer than it is a holiday message, but if you read between the lines, you can see a message in there. It says we love you. Visit mintmobile.com/switch for the offer.
Limited time, new customer offer. Activate within 45 days. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. Unlimited customers using more than 40 gigabytes per month will experience lower speeds. Video streams at 480p. See mintmobile.com for details.
Welcome back to Back Victoria as well. I mean, the very fact that this is 91, so John Major was prime minister then. Welcome Back Victoria is actually written about Margaret Thatcher. and it was written in the Thatcher era. So, I mean, I'm guessing I wrote that in something like 84, 85. Wow. And yes, on Doubt, 6 or 7 years later. I guess that shows that we were kind of fairly... Not desperate for material, but we were looking further than we had done on Liquidizer.
So Right Here, Right Now, was that written about the Cold War ending? Is that right? Did I read that right somewhere?
Yeah, basically, yeah, that's it. It was about the Berlin Wall coming down. I remember just it was that event was one of those things that I, having grown up in the 70s and 80s, you just thought that's always going to be there. It's one of those permanent things, one of those permanent features of life. There will always be this divide between East and West Europe. And when it came down, it was mind-boggling that you could have change on that kind of scale, such a collapse of one system. And also a time of amazing optimism, thinking, well, if we can change that, then, what else can be changed if something that big can disappear? And, this is the end of it. Growing up in the 80s, there was always that threat of you're going to be nuked. That was, if you look back, there's so many films from that era that are about that subject, about, what happens if you in event of a nuclear war. So for that to go away was, a bit of a relief, but also just an astonishing scenario to live through. And that's really what inspired the song, lyrically at least, but musically, Simple Minds had done a cover of Sign of the Times, which I really didn't like. I just thought hasn't added anything to it, and it's kind of missed out all the good bits of it. I thought I'd like to. I had the lyrics Right Here, Right Now going on, I think, or kind of in the background, and I just actually took a loop of Sign of the Times. And everyone was into the Velvet Underground at that time. So I got this Velvet Underground type guitar riff and put it over the top of the loop of Sign of the Times and had the words for Right Here, Right Now. And so the original version was basically just Sign of the Times for 3 minutes. And one two-bar loop of it.
I love that. And then International Bright Young Thing, was that about you travelling around and meeting new people and the excitement of travelling?
Yeah, it was written on a plane flying above Siberia, coming back from Japan at the end of some mad era of touring. I mean, that might have been at the end of the touring of 90. No, it wouldn't have been actually. But I know that in 1991, we toured for 9 months of the year. So we're doing a lot of touring and we're going to new places and we're always meeting new people, interesting people. We're having a brilliant time. I absolutely love touring to this day. And we always did. We were never one of those bands that moaned about it because it was just the most exciting thing. And you meet great people and have great experiences. And that's, it was nice coming out of Britain and kind of seeing people who felt the same or just understanding how they felt different. You know, we'd seen a lot of things from Romania immediately after their revolution to Japan, which was culturally a real shock, but in a fascinating and exciting and interesting way. So, yeah, it was just writing down how it felt to be part of this kind of this wider world that I was experiencing firsthand. It's all very well to kind of say, yeah, it's a wider world and we all have things in common. But when you actually meet these people and, you know, talk to them and, you know, from such different cultures, really exciting. So yeah. And especially when you're kind of out of your mind on a lack of sleep, 8 hours into a 12 hour flight or whatever it is. Yeah. And knowing that you've got to write a song by the time you get off the plane. There might have been some aspects of that I wouldn't write now, but you know, what the hell?
It's fantastic. I know I was obviously going to talk to you today, so I dug out my 45 original copy.
Right, yeah.
It still has its wall sticker in the corner. Just to
wow. Blimey. It's a real article from the past, isn't it?
That's it. I went and bought this. So because me and my mum grew up, we were always skint. Woolworths used to put their singles out. And then after about 3 weeks, they would put it in a bin for 50p. So it's got my 50p. Not to devalue the song, but I had to wait 3 weeks to get it.
That's pretty good. Yeah.
I always had to wait out to get the records I wanted, but I got them in the end. So, But what I love about the album, looking at it in that version, is it like it was a song time capsule, because you was writing about everything around you at the time. I think it's a lovely aspect to those records.
Yeah, I mean, and that was the intention. I did want to capture a kind of a point in time, which is, you know, going back to talking about writing International Bright Young Thing, there was always an element of kind of, yeah, I'm not especially happy with that line, but I'm writing it now and tomorrow's another day. And so we were very much of that mindset. I mean, we knew that we were writing pop music, even though that was a little bit of a dirty phrase, you know, going back to our thing about Slade and the Sweet and how you can be denigrated if you write pop music. We knew that's what we were doing. And I thought that was just part of it. Let it be part of that time. A lot of it does sound very dated. And, you know, I don't mind that at all. I had no plans, but I didn't expect much of it to last, I think. And the fact that we're playing some of those songs now is a kind of double-edged sword. It's kind of nice, but there are sometimes, it's funny, we often talk about it. I mean, Never Enough is the one song that in rehearsals, everyone goes, oh, really, do we have to? You do it live, it's brilliant. It's a great rocking song, and you can see why the record company said, yeah, you've got to put that as a single. You can see why people want to hear it. But in a rehearsal studio, oh, man, that's pulling teeth. We're trying not to play it again.
Oh, I just love how like the album was completely different in parts. Like Real 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 has got like a tribal start to it and a tribal feel as well, and then you've got the pop. It's a wonderful collage of the time. I think it's fantastic. It's Kodos. Honestly, it's a great album. I just thought I'd tell you what I mean.
Well, fabulous. Well, I mean, it's, you know, I was intending it to be a kind of mishmash of things. So I'm really pleased that it became a very easy thing. The approach became very straightforward, it was quite nice kind of thinking, well, here's some mysterious Bulgarian voices. Why not put that with AC/DC? Whereas, you know, kind of 3, 4, 5 years earlier, I wouldn't have thought of it for a moment. But it just kind of opened up a new way of working, which was, you know, which I'm really pleased about. And I think, you know, kind of coincided with a lot of people taking that approach. And now I think it's a standard approach, which is great.
Yeah, yeah. We get to like Perverse about 96. There was a large gap between the albums. Was that due to touring or just writing, or just wanted a break or rest?
Perverse was actually 93, already was 96. Perverse, yeah, we did it. I said in 91 we did 9 months of touring. 92, things slowed down a bit, and I was recording and writing Perverse, and then you have the usual record company thing. I think we finished Perverse in something like June, July, August, something like that. And the record company said, yeah, we're going to put it out in January. So we had a 6-month wait just for a more kind of beneficial release time. By which time I think it was probably too late. That's my favorite Jesus Jones album. I think they get better as they go on. Already the album that came out after that, I really like that. There's plenty of that I can listen to, and quite a bit of Perverse as well. Whereas Doubt, I won't really listen to at all. And Liquidizer, every so often very, very rarely, every 9 months, 18 months, I might listen to something off it, but only if I have to try and remember how the words go, because we're doing a song we haven't played for 10 years. But yeah, so Perverse, I'm really proud of that album. We did take time over it. I think as a reaction to the very sloppy nature of Doubt, Warren Livesey was the producer of Perverse, and I just think he did the most fantastic job, because he took songs that I'd done. It was very much a kind of George Martin to the Beatles, not on comparing myself to the Beatles, but someone who could add in such a creative input to kind of take a song and say, yeah, it's great, but you need to add another section on the end there. And I've never had that before. It was just, here's the song that we might chop out a bit before the first chorus. This is go away, write something else, do something else, add another guitar part. It was like that. And he would then do some stuff that just blew my mind. So we took time working on Perverse. We then, with Already, which came out after that, there were two versions. I think there was one recorded with a couple of guys who worked in a studio that I co-owned at the time. And the second version was the one that Martin Phillips, who produced Right Here, Right Now, that he made. He was very painstaking. I think we took something like 6 months to record his version, having already done the entire album once before with some other people last time, and then the delay for the record company. So there was a 3-year gap between Perverse and Already. But yeah, it was a year and a half, I suppose 2 years between Doubt and Perverse.
I mean, Perverse is a very polished sounding album as well. It sounds completely different, doesn't it? It's like,
absolutely. And that's, it did coincide with me thinking that I should stretch things a little, because the first two albums were often written in a hurry. They were very formulaic, because I had no time, certainly on Liquidize, I have no time for anything other than the formula. You know, as long as it went verse, chorus, middle, chorus, end, fine. I knew I could get it done in the morning and record it in the afternoon. Perverse, it was the first time I'd had a chance to kind of explore things a little bit in all sorts of ways. Warren was very good at adding that kind of that sheen, that polished thing in some ways now that sound very dated, very of their time, kind of late 80s, early 90s, but in some ways that I still think are just fabulous. It created great pieces of music, I think.
Yeah, it's great. It's polished, but it's sort of darker and rockier, and that's the bit that drew me in. Like, it's like, oh, that's the bit that really sort of grabbed me. Like, this isn't the Jesus Jones that I know and love. This is a new band that scares me a bit, and I like it.
Yeah, I mean, and that we felt that was more of a reflection of the actual band that we were. There's, in a way, kind of more in common with Liquidizer and Perverse than Doubt and Perverse because of that. It was us kind of, and to some extent, reacting against our pop notoriety, I guess. I think that's pretty much it. It was a statement album in all ways. We were trying to say, this is who we really are and this is what we're really doing. And the reason it's called Perverse is because we also felt that we were bucking the trend. We were very much swimming against the tide, having everything being pushed forward in the era of kind of Liquidizer, when that kind of technology in dance music was new, and then Doubt onwards, when it suddenly became much more accepted and acceptable. So things, in my view, were kind of progressing and moving forward into the future. Then when grunge happened, and then starting the start of Britpop, we seem to be taking huge steps backwards. And I couldn't understand why I'd be out in these techno clubs hearing sounds of the like of which I'd never heard before, giving the same feeling that I had when I was listening to Blockbuster by the Sweet or Hellraiser by the Sweet. That same kind of feeling, excitement, like, this is amazing. I've never heard something like this before. I didn't understand why we were then going back and listening to our parents' record collections as they were, without really much change. And so by doing an album, we made a big deal out of the fact that we were making a rock album the way a techno artist will make a techno album, which was a perverse thing to do. It wasn't the smart move to make an album that wasn't a very traditional guitar album. But we did it anyway because we felt that was a reflection of who we were and what we were about.
What I did the other day for fun was I played Nine Inch Nails' Downward Spiral album and then Perverse next to each other. And I was sort of going, it could be like a father and son kind of relationship.
Yeah, I found that interesting. We went to America because the industrial scene had started to kick off there. Obviously, you know, Nine Inch Nails and Ministry. And people making comparisons with us and that. And I guess it's just because we were using the technology, in particular drum machines, I guess. I felt there was a big difference between what we did and the industrial stuff. The industrial stuff didn't really have a groove. It wasn't based in dance music. It's not to denigrate it in any way, but it sounded different. It came from a different place. But yeah, you know, I've kind of it's quite nice when people make that comparison. Just because it shows me that there were similar things going on in different places at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you're saying, like Pop Will Eat Itself, like, you know, it's almost the same, but completely different, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
Last year you brought out some new singles, Wired of Wimburn and Where Are All the Dreams. Is there a hint of a new album on the way? Is that why he's releasing the singles?
I'm not sure about an album because these days, you know, it takes a long time to make an album because we do it in a DIY way. Not because we're cheapskates, but actually it's very easy to do that now. The technology has got so good that I can do it all in the room I'm talking to you from now. And when I say I can do it all, I'm getting files emailed over from our bass player in Chicago. Jen, our drummer, now has this electronic drum kit, and he just plays into his computer and then sends me a tiny little file, and that's it. You know, I can then give him John Bonham sound if that's what he wants, or someone else's sound if, you know, that's what he wants. So I can tie it all in here, I guess, is what I'm saying. But no, but doing it that way, and also writing, just finding the time, find the time to write. No, it's not really that. It's actually finding inspiration. You know, I've been writing songs now since my early teens and kind of late 50s now. So, It gets harder to write, I think. It gets harder to listen to music in the same way that I did before. I still find a lot of music really inspiring, but not as much as I did. I don't feel kind of part of a scene. I don't feel involved in a scene in any way. So it's harder to write. It's lengthier to record. And as a result, I don't think an album... I think we might accrue an album's worth of songs over the next 5 years is probably the best answer to your question.
Okay. Are you still in your mind an environmental songwriter now? Or do you write differently? Like we were saying, obviously that was very about the surroundings. Do you feel the same? You write the same way now? Or do you sort of write not to order, but in a sort of non-personal way?
I try and steer clear of the kind of the socio-political commentary, which I did a lot of before, partly because I did a lot of it before, but partly because it doesn't, unless you can tie it into an emotion, I don't think it's all that engaging. I still struggle with writing lyrics. I never set out to be a lyric writer or a singer for that matter. I find it very difficult. I don't think I do it very well very often. There are sometimes I can do a good job of it, but I think it's more by accident than by design. And I do think when I write words by design, they're generally something I'm not all that pleased with. I tend to write just if I've got something to write about or I want to write, then I do it. That's how it's done now. Again, in complete contrast to, you know, Liquidizer, which is you will have a song by the end of today. That's all that there was. Whereas now, yeah, so that's why, again, an album would take so long to do because I'd be waiting to find something to write about that I wanted to write about.
That's fair enough. If people want to find out about yourself and Jesus Jones, where's the best place to find information about the band and the tours and the albums? And
JesusJones.com. I guess, you know, we're on Twitter, we're on all of the socials, and the usual places that people would want to find out. It's always pretty obvious. Ian, the keyboard player from the band, does a great job, and he's got a team of other people helping him spread the word left, right, and centre. So we're very easy to get hold of if you want to find out.
Fantastic, and I'll put links in the bottom. Thanks for chatting today, Mike. It's been an absolute pleasure, mate.
Oh, it's a pleasure to speak to you as well.
A massive thank you to Mike Edwards for the interview. Don't forget to like and subscribe and tell your friends about the show, and to play us out, Jesus Jones with a new track, Wired and Windburned.
Days in the sunshine. What a shame. It burns my skin. I like to think of me climbing every mountain. But the pain of me is your adventure feature. Favorite history, Neolithic man with a maths degree. It's easy making the grade full of photos. I've got what it takes, got the right clothes.